My name is Michael McCusker. I have a very raspy throat and a pair of sore lungs, I believe, as a result of this cold air. So I might stop for a few moments to clear the throat in the course of the reading of this morning. And probably most of you are aware that yesterday was Pearl Harbor Day, 70. I am also 70. But I wonder if many of you remember that today is the anniversary of the great Astoria Fire of 1922. I would like to read about that fire. And that's exactly what I call it. I wrote it, so therefore I should give a disclaimer that this is my account and perhaps my opinion only in the entire cosmos and parallel universes. And my name is Michael McCusker, if I did not introduce myself at the beginning. Start with a item from the Portland Telegram from December 8th, 1922. With the heart of its business district wiped out by fire and with part of the lower residence district in ashes, one of its leading citizens dead and many more or less seriously injured, Astoria, the oldest town in the state of Oregon, at 11 o'clock today, was only a bleak scar on the banks of the wide reaches of the Columbia. My friend Roger Martin was incinerated in a fire that started in his downtown Astoria flower shop and ravaged half a city block Thanksgiving night 3 years ago. Beg your pardon. The fire apparently started with an electrically overloaded hot plate while Roger was asleep in the apartment he lived in upstairs from the flower shop. The fire gutted the local Bank of America on Commercial Street, an all-hours coffee shop, Cabies, that had recently opened and was popular with overnight taxi drivers, a Japanese cafe, Tokyo Teriyaki, a photo studio, Ravens, and briefly endangered the Drina Daisy restaurant on the west end of the block, as well as the venerable Labor Temple and Cafe and Bar on the block's reverse side. The Thanksgiving fire of 2008 was the worst since the Great Astoria Fire of 1922, which demolished virtually the entire downtown, including structures the newer casualties had more or less replaced. Volunteer fire departments from Olney, Waluski, Lewis and Clark, Warrenton, Napa, Gearhart, and Seaside responded to the three-alarm fire call that kept them busy past dawn Friday morning. Today, December 8, 2011, is the 89th anniversary of the Great Astoria Fire. This next April will be 23 years since a house I lived in on Astoria's Bond Street caught fire in the early hours of morning. A man died in that fire also, Coleman Slice, whose lighted cigarette caused the first of his two cremations and set the house on fire. That was in 1989. The year an arsonist attempted to ignite Astoria aflame once again. I remember being awakened in my basement apartment by shouts of fire. I quickly dressed and stepped outside into pre-dawn darkness, flared by a crown of flames above my head. I looked up and saw the end of a part of my life, unaware at first that the life of the man whose cigarette ignited him and the house had totally ended. Hours later, after Coleman Slice's charred corpse was hauled away for a second cremation, wires and pipes unplugged from the burnt house in the manner life support is removed from the dead in a hospital, I stared at the smoking ruin, a house built in the first year of the 20th century, a survivor of the great fire that destroyed Astoria's heart just before Christmas, 1922. I am not sure how far I can expand the burning of a single apartment house with the holocaust of a city center, nor can I quite compare it to the immolation of half a city block 3 years ago. Yet the year my house burned, 1989, which was the centennial of the Great Seattle Fire of 1889, a pyromaniac attempted to incinerate the city a third time. The first was in 1883, which also burned the city core. Even now, 22 years later, friends confuse my fire, which gave me, a former volunteer fireman, a chance to help in the attempt to save my house, and a fire set simultaneously by an aggrieved lover to his former girlfriend's house with the 20 or so fires the pyro set during those frantic months of flame and fear. The link is the fear. Even those not born when the Great Astoria Fire obliterated the city center 67 years earlier felt a visceral backdraft of memory, a collective dread Astoria might burn again. Every siren that year evoked a pervasive silence that heightened the echoing shriek of ambulance, police car, or fire truck. Each time it seemed as if the city held its breath and only the siren was palpable, until it stopped, like the Nazi buzz bombs of World War II that augured death and destruction when their motors suddenly cut off and they fell onto whoever was haplessly underneath them. The young man caught and convicted of torching parts of Astoria for 7 months of it 1989 turned out to be the son of a fireman who apparently abused the boy. He set fire to Longview, Washington structures in his first surge of revenge against his firefighting father. He spent a few years in jail. Freed from prison, he drifted downriver and lighted his matchbook where we live. A letter to the Daily Astorian vividly illuminates those months of terror. Who is trying to kill us? Why all the fire? We are like guards in our own home, afraid to sleep, weary at work, afraid to go anywhere, hoping we have a home to come back to. I remember the volunteer fireman from Lewis and Clark who almost fried trying to get to the body of Coleman Schleiss upstairs in my house when suddenly the stairs they climbed collapsed in flames. They survived only because their comrades instantly immersed them in hose spray. One of those saved, a good friend whom I have ever since regarded with gratitude and respect for what he did that day, told me it was the hottest fire he had ever fought. I wonder how he might have considered the 1922 fire. Here is where the personal expands, the lone tragedy, a tributary vein spilling over into a true cataclysm. If my friend and I had been firemen when Astoria conflagrated 89 years ago, we would have been at considerably more disadvantage than at my fire or any others we have as volunteer firefighters been called out to extinguish. The first absurdity we would have encountered, which firemen in those days must have long dreaded, was the city's plumbing system, little more than a medieval maze of wooden troughs, though most seem to have been enclosed. When firefighters depended upon a reliable water supply for their hoses, these water mains were part of the firestorm rather than its solution, and their hoses burst on the hot streets, which were in most places wooden planks nailed over wooden pilings. Can you imagine how hard they must have worked to stop the fire? Every time they lost a street, they fought for the next one, breathing smoke, no respirators or face masks, burning up in sweat from the inferno, yet chilled by a cold night wind that fanned the fire. Block after block consumed by flames, forcing firefighters to retreat as the fire irresistibly advanced. Firemen fought to save City Hall and St. Mary's Hospital. Patients were removed to Astoria High School. Walter Matula wrote in the Astorian Budget, commemorating the fire's 25th anniversary in 1947. Where there was no water, dynamite was substituted. Hotels, dwellings, and street intersections went up, and the fire went on. The Great Astoria Fire was comparable in its local effect to the fires that swept through Rome in 64 AD, London, 1666, Chicago, 1871, and San Francisco in 1906. The fire burned for 22 hours, destroyed 32 blocks in the city's heart, and left at least 2,000 homeless. Three persons died, one possibly an unrelated suicide, and damages were estimated at nearly $30 million. The fire's origins were never determined. Aid poured in from all over. Portland contributed $53,000, and Victor Astor in New York, heir of John Jacob Astor, whose Hunter Explorers founded Astoria in 1811, contributed $5,000, a paltry sum considering his heritage and legacy. And, of course, This is Astoria's bicentennial this year. Madla wrote that by 1922, Astoria was an out-of-date city of deteriorating wooden buildings. Its waterfront had been built up for making money in handling grain, shanghaiing and fleecing its large male population of seamen, fishermen, and loggers. This waterfront empire was dying. The town still retained the name of a wide-open hangout, but the money in crime was gone. So was the big shipping of the 1870s and 80s. The cannery empire was past its prime. The Chinese and Hindus employed in the canneries and mills were gone and left behind their combustible shacks. The fire started a few minutes after 2 a.m. on December 8th. It raged all day. The fire kept on coming, north, south, east, and west, often breaking out far ahead of the cauldron at the heart of the doomed city, Madla wrote in his article. Power failed. Gas mains burst and blazed. Cars, trucks, wheelbarrows, and stooped backs and held out arms carried away goods from stores. Stacks of office furniture, phonographs, records, boxes, and bundles of articles, fur coats, dishes, lodge paraphernalia, all the goods of the city were heaped back of the fire. They had to be moved again as the fire advanced. Looters snatched goods, broke into stores, and carried off stocks in the guise of helping out. It was bright as day in Astoria, except in basements, inner rooms, and where smoke rolled thick. And that's Madela. Headlines in Oregon newspapers that day told the story. Astoria's heart in ruins. City destroyed by flames. Fire raises 35 blocks. Astoria business district destroyed. Telephone girls stick until flames reach building. Stores and offices in fiery pile. Astoria swept by greatest conflagration in Northwest history. Among buildings razed by the mad sweep of flames, and that was from the Portland Telegram, that quote, Weinhardt Hotel, Beehive Department Store, Hafer Confectionery, J.C. Penney Store, Astoria Budget Newspaper Plant, Astoria Theater, Oddfellow Hall, First National Bank, Astoria Savings Bank, Western Union Telegraph Office, Merwin Hotel, Staples Motor Company, Elks Club, Astoria National Bank, Columbia Trust and Savings Company, Bank of Commerce, Skalrud's Dry Goods Store, Astoria Drug Store, Central Drug Store, Dayton Drug Store, Owl Drug Store, Allen & Lewis Wholesale Grocery, Mason Ehrman Wholesale Grocery, Blue Mouse Theater, Liberty Theater, Star Theater, YWCA Building, Astoria Business College, Morning Astorian, North Star Hotel, Troy Laundry, Astoria Opera House, Methodist Church, Baptist Church, Central Fire Station. Madla named a few of the Astoria firemen who fought the big fire. Mel Grimberg, Otto K. Banksund, Dobie Backlund, Os Manula, Henry Jochemsen, Tiny Aragoni, Clarence McCoy, Dutch McCroskey, Frank Smart, Paul Kearney, Fred Lazell, Tony Antonik, Tim Aldrich, Harry Yeager, Fred Lazan, Arvid Heinonen, Jack Cochran, Victor Olin, Sam Berg, Al Greiken, Leo Fernie, Al Davis, Jimmy Coffin, Walter Christofferson, Joe Schomburger, Wayne Osterby, and Fire Chief Charles Foster, veteran of the 1883 fire and newly elected vice president of the Pacific Coast Fire Chiefs Association. The three who died were Norris Staples, president of the Bank of Commerce and owner of Staples Motor Company, who dropped dead of a heart attack pushing a car to safety. Jack Cornelison, a deckhand aboard the tugboat Oneonta, who fell into the river, misjudging the distance to the 16th Street dock in the smoke. And a person identified by Madla as a logger, whose body was found hanging the next morning under the Sanborn dock. Although this man's suicide has been historically regarded as unrelated to the fire, and there seems to be little official curiosity about his identity, a question might be asked if he killed himself for being responsible for the fire's as yet unknown origins. By 6 a.m., quote, all of Astoria that once stood on stilts over the river was burning, Mattila wrote. From then on, the fire was gradually put under control, with some losses. Late in the day, snow fell over the black ruins of the old Astoria, but melted in the embers that glowed for weeks while the new Astoria was born. Astorians, all of them, as if their spirits had been tempered in fire, took on the task of rebuilding their city. In the blackest hour of destruction, there was no wailing voice of defeat. And that was Walter Mattila. The Portland Telegram said the same thing later that same day. Astoria's calmly listing its losses and already thinking how it will rebuild. The Telegram said in its lead article on page one that probably a total of 32 blocks in the retail heart of the city were destroyed beyond repair, and around this is a fringe of partly damaged buildings, many of which will have to be torn down. At the end of the day, Astoria's heart was a smoldering ruin or had dropped into the river and sizzled. Three people were dead, hundreds homeless. My Bond Street apartment house was 22 years old that year, same as the century. It was on the westward fringe of the fire's final advance. Astoria City Hall, on the east end, also survived, but the fire killed it as the center of municipal administration. A decade later, the city discarded it for a downtown bank building built since the fire. The old City Hall is now the Heritage Museum of Clatsop County Historical Society. Before the fire, the deteriorating downtown was slowly being abandoned by business and politics eastward to a newer section of the city. The fire altered that migration, and the city center was resurrected on its ruins, similar to the regrowth of forests after fire. Compared to its abundance of 19th century hillside dwellings, downtown Astoria is relatively young, most of it having been reconstructed from the ruins of the Great Astoria Fire. Though the city repaired itself, substituting landfill for flammable pilings and piers along the riverfront, the boom days had long been over before the fire, and they never came back. Fishing had already fallen off its peak before the fire, and the big trees nearly logged from the surrounding forests. Astoria's prominence as a port city diminished, becoming hardly more than a parking lot for ships awaiting the large ports upriver. At present, as a result of rather slapdash and ill-conceived redecoration of building fronts, as well as neglect and deterioration, the downtown area as a whole looks dowdy and out of focus despite heroic attempts to brighten up a few buildings. Not quite Walter Mattila's vision of a city reborn from the flames. Astoria is in search of another renewal through salvage of its despoiled past. Old Astoria is the engine that drives present-day Astoria, manipulated by a self-promoting tourist industry that scrubs out the grime of the city's reckless history to display a Disneyland-like gay 90s fantasy while advertising Astoria as a museum without walls. The big fire of 1922, the fault line of Astoria's history, separating in public memory the boom times from the insipid, might realistically, and perhaps metaphorically, be called the city's high water mark. The Astoria City Council declared downtown a historical district in 1979, and as a result of renewed tourist interest and Lewis and Clark bicentennial publicity a few years back, a renaissance of Astoria has been declared, although the current national financial crisis, perhaps equal to the Great Crash of 1929, 7 years after the Great Astoria Fire, has dimmed the city's near-future economic prospects. I nurture an illusory romance with Astoria, a paradox illustrated by a woman I made my muse of the city, similar to symbolisms of women as liberty and justice, earth and nature, though she has lived in several elsewheres for most of the time I have known her. I am credited with knowledge of local history, but I know next to nothing, except I feel a direct empathy with my predecessors, whose lives I feel mine warps into as I occupy their space in a later time. I usually don't think of the big fire when I walk downtown, nor, I imagine, do most others I see on the sidewalks or driving past on streets that were blackened rubble or fallen in flames into the river. It's probably the same in war-shattered cities rebuilt since the world wars, new generations trotting upon unseen and barely remembered tragedies of the past, such as the rebuilt pyre of my friend Roger Martin. Yet, for most of this past year, I have been able to envision the fire-blasted ruins of that Christmas season 89 years ago, the charred remnants from a firestorm last December that incinerated several downtown waterfront businesses that were located in renovated fish cannery buildings on pilings above the river, which included the Cannery Cafe and Hip Fish magazine. And that was a story I wrote. And have rewritten a couple of times. And I'd like to read something from the Spring 2011 Cumtux by Clatsop County Historical Quarterly. It's a letter to the editor, and it's from a fellow named Frank Cerns. And it was to the Daily Budget. And it says to the editor from the People, "Kindly permit me to say a few words through your columns anent the recent resignation of 11 men from the Astoria Fire Department in protest from the Astoria Fire Department." The recent resignation of 11 men from the Astoria Fire Department in protest against the dismissal of Chief Foster. And I should mention this was in the Astoria Daily Budget, January 12, 1923. "Having spent over 8 years as a regular in the fire department, I have always felt a deep interest in its affairs, and since leaving there a few years ago, I've kept in touch with conditions through the budget. I knew all of these men intimately, having worked with most of them and having fought many a fire with them. And I want to tell the readers of the budget that when these firemen left the department, the city was the loser. They were not a few disgruntled men, as I have seen stated in one of the papers, but they were the cream of firefighters. They are a lot of inside things that happen in fire department work, which the general public does not see, and these are the good things that go to make up a good department. It was my pleasure to make a close study of the department conditions throughout the West while a member of the Astoria Department, and it could be safely boasted that there was not a better set of fighters than these on the Pacific Coast. It is true that a fire finally got away from them, but it is no more than we have looked for these many years, especially since 1916, when the fire trap was created in the downtown district by the construction of viaduct streets without adequate firewalls. Let me tell you and the good people of Astoria that there has been many a fire over there that threatened to go as this one did, and if it had not been for the gallant work of these men, their fierce and bitter determination, your town would have gone long ago. They were the kind of men who make good firemen. They were good men and true, but they have now passed on. This recalls the first of the old bunch to go, Jesse Jenkins, who in a shipwreck off the California coast some 8 years ago gave up his life to save two women. Then there was Dickie Dealey, who used to long for the gong to tap so he would have a chance to fight, and the never-to-be-forgotten Paul Marion, who was killed in a fall down the pole hole 3 years ago. You did not have to pound these boys on the back to get them into the fire. I have seen Frank Smart at the nozzle standing up to a rushing fire and watched the blisters rise up and break on his hands and his helmet warp with the terrific heat, but move not an inch. I have seen Jochumsen refuse to budge when the smoke was so thick the only thing that kept them alive was the oxygen coming through the hose, and he finally had to be pulled out. I have seen Andrich and Davis stick to their post until they were almost completely blind from the heat and smoke and had to be guided home. I know that in the recent fire, Kaufman stuck to the line until the swirling nozzle threw him against a wall, almost senseless, after three outside men had dropped the hose and run. Yes, I could go on for hours reciting the heroic work of these men, but time and space prevents names to go down in the department history with the best of them. They were firemen all through, those boys. You did not see any of that bunch stand on the hill with the spectators and watch the Hammond Mill burn because it was their day off, or drop the hose at a fire and run because it got too hot for them, deserting a comrade, and then hold their job through political nincompoopery. We wish the Astoria and the department well in the future, but it will not be easy to pick up a bunch like that. It has been said in one of the papers lately that Foster lacked organization in the department. If having a bunch of firemen like that who would follow him through Hades and who knew their work like a book is lack of organization, then the word is a joke. There were no captains and lieutenants in that bunch. They did not need any. When you bring that stuff into a small fire department, you start trouble. When Foster was there, they took orders from him alone and they carried them out. In his absence, there was a boss provided for, and they all recognized him. Why, Smart, Jochimson, Kearney, and several of the others were trained as firefighters when they were still boys with a view to working them in later years, and when the opening came, they were ready to step into it and were trained firemen. His system was good, but the only trouble with Foster was that he was not a good publicity agent. He spent too much time doing his work and not enough in letting the public know about it. I have never seen a chaotic condition at any Astoria fire, and will wager that even in the late Great Fire, everything was orderly so far as the firemen were concerned. Also, there has never been a piece of apparatus held up for a lack of a man to run it. Some men were good fire eaters who were not apparatus men, but if Portland, Seattle, or San Francisco can produce any better apparatus men than McCoy, Jochimson, or Smart, I would like to see them. Well, led on with the new city success and trust that the fire department will build up again, but in passing pay a tribute to these boys who are now forced out of it. I suffered quite a little financial loss in the fire myself, but know that not one penny of it would have gone if the nerve of these men and their leader could have saved it. I take off my hat to some of the greatest firefighters that ever used a turnout suit. Astoria should be proud of them, even if they did fight a losing fight, and should at least wish them well as they push on. Signed, Frank Kearns. And Frank Kearns was born in 1892 in Oregon and raised in Astoria. At age 18, he worked for the Astoria Fire Department. About 1920, he moved to South Bend, Pacific County, Washington, where he later owned a hardware store. He died in 1977. Frank was a nephew of Chief Charles Edward Foster and had lived with him and Ed's mother, Jane Gilmore Foster. Ed Foster had been ousted from the fire department when the Ku Klux Klan had taken over the city offices in 1923, but regained his office in 1926. I'm not sure if the 11 men who were forced out from the fire department because they protested against the dismissal of Chief Foster were ever rehired, but given this letter, they should have been. And this has been Michael McCusker. I will see you next week if the sky doesn't fall or I get run over by a truck or plunge into the river.